You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Yesterday, the New York Times reported that Madison Avenue ad agencies are trying to improve their marketing strategies to moms. According to the article, mothers are a crucial market for advertisers because of all the money they spend on goods and services, an estimated $2.3 trillion a year in the U.S. alone. But as Martin Lindstrom, a branding expert, explains in his latest book, existing marketing techniques to mothers, children, and every other subcategory are already pretty sophisticated. His book, Brand Washed, Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy, which is a follow-up to his bestseller, Biology, explores corporate branding efforts and how they increase our desire to buy. It's published by Crown Business, and I'm very pleased that it brings Martin Lindstrom back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
Good to see you again.
Likewise.
You make the case that branding begins in the womb. How a market is penetrating that market?
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story. When I was a kid, I loved to listen to Bossa Nova. And I still love Bossa Nova. It gives me this warm feeling. And I just asked my mom and dad some time ago when I started to write Brand Wars, how come I love Bossa Nova? Did you listen a lot to it? And my dad tells me an unusual story. When I was just about to be born, they actually had this record they were playing every day. That whole record player fell on the floor, broke into pieces the very moment they went to the hospital, so they'd never been listening to Bossa Nova music while I've been alive. But they did it while I was in the womb. And that actually made me realize that when we are still in the uterus, we're actually affected by the sense of sound and taste. And because of that, I started to investigate, can brands be built while we're still unborn?
And didn't a candy company distribute samples to pregnant women and find out that the resulting children showed a strong preference for the flavor of that candy?
You're absolutely right. We actually learned by investigating across Asia that there is a company called Copico, which actually supposedly have specialized in catching, you know, pregnant women during the pregnancy and give them a candy which is flavored with a coffee flavor. Now, it happens to be so they're also producing coffee, and it actually primes the unborn babies to have a preference for this coffee. And I witnessed firsthand as I was walking around in Asia that these newborn babies, funny enough, scary enough, had a preference for that particular coffee brand at the age of, you know, 6 months, 2 years.
In Asia, where tea, of course, is the predominant drink.
Well, it depends. You know, if you take a look at the Philippines and Korea, you'll see it's pretty high there. But absolutely, you're right. In China and other places, you will see the tea is pretty prominent. But I find it scary. And we've seen this happening across shopping malls, across Asia as well, where they actually work on campaigns which are targeting pregnant women in order to persuade them to indirectly persuade the unborn children.
But only in Asia?
So far, so yes. That's the reason why I'm writing about it in the book, because what I'm scared about is that this is just the early beginning.
Well, I've heard that by the age of 3, children can recognize 100 brand logos. And that's everywhere, isn't it?
It is very global. It definitely is in the United States, but also in Asia. You will see that the first word a baby can say, not just the word, you know, mom or dad, the first word is actually McDonald's or Donald's. And it shows you how effective the brands are. I've quite often try to sit in a car where the baby in the back seat or the front seat is saying Donald's as they pass by a sign. It has become such an integrated part of our lives that quite often when we did experiments with babies to understand what's going on with brands, that they're not saying, I want milk anymore. They're saying a milk brand. They don't want to have water anymore. They're saying a water brand. So we really have changed the entire vocabulary of human beings, which is pretty sad.
And how has that happened? Through advertising?
Well, it happens through advertising, but it also happens through the fact that the parents are starting to affect the children a lot. Think about the Apple brands. If you take the iPad or the iPod, they actually have become almost a piece of entertainment tool for babies, a pacifier, you could say so. And today we can see that it's one of the most popular tools parents are giving to their children in order to entertain them. Some of the most popular computer games and applications on the iPad, in fact, are baby games. So it starts at a very young age. And I just want to tell you a funny story, Leonard, because we did an experiment with babies between 9 months and 36 months of age. And I gave them a BlackBerry. And then we tried to explain as well as we could that they should switch it on. And they took their small little fingers and swiped it over the screen, just as if it was an iPod. They wanted to see the light. And what's interesting here is that already that on young age, we're affected by a brand.
You've called your third chapter, I Can't Quit You, Brand Addicts, Shopaholics, and Why We Can't Live Without Our Smartphones. And this is something that starts very early?
Well, the addiction, or whatever we may call it, starts at a very young age. And we do see today that when I'm observing young babies, young children in private homes, which I spend a lot of time doing all the time, when they today want to change channel, they will crawl over the floor to the television and swipe their fingers over the whole screen. If they want to enlarge the picture, they'll take both of the hands and enlarge it exactly the same way as you do your little display on your iPad. So what happens is that we are changing the whole navigation format from being a non-branded to a branded navigation.
Of course, in the case of smartphones, people who did not grow up with them are also addicted. And they can be great resources from everything from locating the nearest ATM machine to settling a dispute at a bar.
Yeah, they could and they can and they are right now. I call that contextual branding. And really what it is that in the future, which is right now, we will receive the right message at the right time to the right audience. And that will be so contextual that it will depend on not just where you are, but what the temperature will be outside. And perhaps even more scary, how popular you are among your friends. Because what happens right now is that the popularity of individuals is now being mapped down by concepts like Google+. So now we know who is very popular and therefore who people are listening to.
Gary Steingart wrote a novel recently in which he talked about that. You enter a room and people will know just how popular you are and whether you're attractive to members of the opposite sex. And at the time, it sounded like science fiction.
And now it's reality.
Now it's reality.
Yeah, it is. Because you have to remember, and that's what we learned as part of this book project, that the popularity of you as an individual will determine how many people will listen to you. And I don't need to tell you that if you're using Gmail, which is a free service, your price is that they will be able to put in ads into your Gmail, customized around your search inquiries or the words you've been using in the email application. Now, if they can see that you are really popular, of course, the price tag to advertise on your email will actually go up. And that's exactly what's happening right now.
And Google's making a lot of money. Every time you click on one of those ads, they make money.
They do, and what they do now is... And
they even know which ads are more effective by which ones get the most clicks, and they charge more for that.
Well, I wish that was just the whole story, but you're absolutely right, but there's more to this story, because now we also know that if you click on this ad, we can see how many of your friends are clicking on that because you were recommending something to them. And that means that you have this indirect viral effect. Which means that it may be that you are very cheap to advertise on because you're not affecting people, but other people will be really expensive because they have a huge influence in the community.
Now, you work as a consultant in this business. Are you biting the hand that feeds you?
Perhaps I am. No, I think.
Did they get upset? Martin, we hired you to work on a project, and then you blew the lid on it in one of your books.
I think the reality is that most of the companies right now are reaching a level where they need to create a house which is in order. The problem is right now that a lot of companies do not have their ethics in order. And I do think that right now we're reaching a level of the WikiLeaks of the future where brands will be disclosed. So really, this is me helping brands to be prepared to be on the ethical path.
My guest is Martin Lindstrom, whose latest book, Brandwashed, Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy, has a foreword by Morgan Spurlock. It's published by Crown Business. Can you walk our listeners through the incredible story of how Calvin Klein developed the fragrance Euphoria?
Well, the amazing story goes back to the fact that when we develop a smell today, the smell has to evoke certain memories in our mind. And the whole trick is, of course, to find out how do you link the memories together with the word it should stand for. So what they're doing today is that, for example, they're building up huge warehouses, the fragrance companies are, and those warehouses are each representing different rooms with different fragrances in them. So what they do now is that they take people through those rooms, which means ordinary consumers. They are half awake, half asleep. And because they're in that state of non-conscious behavior, they also can express their emotions much more accurately than if you are fully awake. And as they're guided through this dark funnel of different rooms, they will go into one room which have some light in the background. They will smell a smell, and then they will express their feelings. And because they are half asleep, they actually will also be able to express what they feel about this perfume. Because you have to remember, perfume is really difficult to explain because it's a smell and how to express that. And that's really the technique they've used right now with the Calvin Klein to drive people through this labyrinth of emotions. And after that, they then determine the one word which people were expressing the most through this whole exercise.
So it's the word rather than the fragrance that matters? Or do people say, I like this smell the best, and does that become the one that they use for the perfume?
Well, actually, it's not necessarily what they like the best. It's more which one evokes the right emotions in your mind. Yeah, in this case, euphoria. So if everything seems to come together and that's the emotion you're generating, that's what they want to go ahead with, because they don't want just to have something you like best. Because what about in another market where it may be your smell preference is different, but where the emotion seems to be the same?
We'll take a little break and we'll come back with more. I want to talk about Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and how fear drives so much of the marketing that we respond to. My guest, Martin Lindstrom, who was voted one of the world's most influential people of 2009 by Time magazine. He's advised top executives at companies like McDonald's, Procter & Gamble, and Microsoft. His previous book, Biology, was a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller and the USA Today Pick of the Year. Stay with us. We're back with Martin Lindstrom. His book, Brandwashed, Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy. It's published by Crown Business. Urban, organic, and healthy eating Americans who shop at Whole Foods might believe that they're not being manipulated, but the story that changed stealth marketing comes up several times in your book. Can you talk about some of their techniques, like the fresh flowers in the front of the stores and the chalk on slate prices?
Well, you have to think about that a retail store is like a theater. And the better you are at staging this theater, the more we actually are going to a certain state of mind, which makes us pay more and buy more. So what Whole Foods has been amazing at doing is to staging it very well. You walk into Whole Foods, they're cutting the fresh cut flowers, and at indirectly level in our brains, we're thinking, gee, everything in this store is fresh. And it's not to say it's not fresh, but we certainly believe that up front. Whereas if I was changing the whole scenarios and you're seeing canned soups and things with expiration dates of 4 years, you will have a different view of the entire store, right? Now, as you walk into the store, and by the way, just to give you some insight here, typically you would have to walk anti-clockwise around the store because it makes you spend 7% more as a consumer. And then
they kind of direct you, even though you don't realize you're being directed?
Absolutely. And because we do know today that most of us are right-handed people, and therefore we grab things with our right hand rather than our left hand. So that makes us spend more. And even things like, for example, and this is not in Whole Foods, but some other retailers, they're putting in speed bumps into the floor, which really at a non-conscious level makes us slow down and spend an average 15 seconds more on a certain section, which, by the way, just to put a number on that, makes us spend $3 more. So this is really some of the tricks which are used.
Nutritionist Marion Nessel suggests that you just stay away from all the center aisles in a supermarket because all of the food that you really need is on the outer rim.
That's right. And not only that, typically you will see that the corners on each of the different aisles have been rounded because it actually makes you go round and round and round. And you have to remember, an average woman reaching the age of 63 here in the United States is spending 25,817 hours through life shopping in a retail store. So it's a long time, and if you can really increase that time, we spend more. So coming back to Whole Foods, what they're doing is that instead of just having cardboard boxes with whatever patties farm, they actually have gigantic dummies. It looks like smaller cardboard boxes, but in reality, it's just a stage format to make us believe everything is from the farm.
You write about the cantaloupe boxes. Now, cantaloupes may be out of favor at the moment because of the listeria outbreak, but you tell a story about discovering that a tower of old-fashioned cantaloupe boxes that looked like it was about to be unpacked was, in fact, a manufactured set piece?
Well, quite often you'll see that in most retailers, everything is a set piece. You know, even the crushed eyes in those big containers in wood, and where you have the fresh produce placed on top of the eyes, is also to set the stage to make us believe this is incredibly fresh. But most of the products have an expiration date of 1, 2, or 3 months. But again, if it's fresh, then it makes us change our mind.
What about the misting that we see in many supermarkets? Well, does that do any real good? It always makes me feel like they care about keeping that produce really fresh.
Well, you know, if you ask some of the manufacturers behind this, they actually will also admit that the misting makes you feel things are really fresh because we're primed to do so. The reality, however, is that most of the products actually are rotting quicker, because it has this exposure to water every 5th minute, and therefore it's just deteriorating quicker. And not only that, we also see today that some of the manufacturers now are working with a color code. That means when you buy your fresh bananas and they have this perfect buttercup yellow shine to it, it's not because it is that color. There's two reasons why. First of all, there's a filter put into the light, so it makes them seem a little bit more yellow.
They put a filter in the light over the bananas?
Some of the retailers are doing that. But another thing which is even more scary is that they have a color code palette in the back, which basically tells you that if it reads a Pantone color of 2259, which is the perfect buttercup color, then people are more likely to buy that than if it has a more greeny gray to it. So really, these products are not released based on when they're best, but based on when we believe they're best.
But I've been in other countries where people have done some pretty clever things. If you go through a market in Mexico, everything is put into colored buckets. Beautifully displayed in colored buckets, and they just, and sometimes you see this in Europe as well, the color always seems to be the perfect color to display the color of the peaches or the bananas or whatever. People have understood these things for a long, long time, haven't they?
They have, but I think the difference is that that was understood at the local farm, at the local market. But you have to remember, if you take some of the biggest retailers like Whole Foods or like Trader Joe's, they are not a local market. They want to pretend like they are a local market. They want you to get the feeling that the local truck was, you know, backing up in front of the main door, directly imported from the farm this morning. The reality is it was flown in with an air jet in plastic containers.
And you say that applies also to the way that Whole Foods displays a whole fish on ice in their cases.
Well, you know, very few people, particularly here in New York City, is buying a whole fish. They're buying pieces of it because we live alone or we just can't handle a big fish. And what we know
and
to
we do... And we also don't want to fillet it ourselves.
No, we don't know how to do it. That's even worse, right? So what you do is that you buy the image of how things were at a farm. You look at the big fish. It's never sold, by the way. What's sold is the small chopped up pieces. And just to give you a sense of this, I actually did an experiment in Europe recently where I took frozen fish and put it on crushed ice. And when you see frozen fish on crushed ice, it sells better than if you take frozen fish just in a freezer, because we believe that crushed ice makes it become more authentic. So that's how we built to be brand washed.
Does Trader Joe's employ some of the same tactics as Whole Foods in its marketing?
They do. You could say that Trader Joe's in many ways are picking up on many of the signals and ideas which Whole Foods have developed. Trader Joe's has done something else which I find fascinating. If you buy some of their paper bags with chocolates in it, you have this big bar which you can see that chopped into small pieces, and I'm sure a housewife were doing it somewhere, we don't know where, but the reality is it's not the case. If you take those pieces of a chocolate, all of them are uneven and unperfect, and you line them up next to each other, next to another bag with chocolate, you'll see they're exactly the same size and shape, because it's manufactured uneven, manufactured authentic, so it makes us feel this is developed in a local factory around the corner, whereas the reality is probably slightly different.
You also write about how Five Guys stacks sacks of potatoes in the middle of the store and uses a whiteboard to announce where today's potatoes come from.
Yes, because it makes us feel we're closer to the farm. Here's the reality. None of us really are spending time on a farm anymore. We're losing the contact with the farm and the real nature, so we're desperate to get back to nature. So we know today from experiments that the more I show green colors or imitated windows of greens behind it, the more happy we get and the more we buy. And also what happens is it plugs into our nostalgic feeling, because we show today, we now note from brain science that we actually remember the past much more rosy than the present time. So if you get this romantic feeling as you walk through the supermarket, you in fact are buying more. And if it's topped up with music which were played once you were young, which exactly the case is in Whole Foods, they're always playing music from the 80s because that's where you and I were young. Well, then it makes us feel that warm and fussy sensation, and we buy a little bit more because suddenly we are the center of the universe.
Now, how did they come up with all of this? Do they just hire a team of psychologists to say, play music from the 80s?
Well, it's a mixture, I think.
Because my supermarket doesn't play music from the 80s. I often get very annoyed at what they are playing, and sometimes I actually mutter under my breath, oh, shut up.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think it's a mixture. I think it's trial and error. I think that Whole Foods, and they're a great supermarket, but they have learned a lot from what works and what doesn't work. There's no doubt about it at all that they have experts. So the music which is piped through the speakers is actually the same music across the whole country, coming from a specialized company. So yes, it's a mixture.
A listener, Teresa in Park Slope, left this message on our show page. When this segment started, I thought my 1.5-year-old and I were above this. She's never had soda, never eaten at McDonald's, doesn't watch TV, and doesn't know common global brands. And then as I patted myself on the back for my superior parenting, I realized some of her early words were iPad and apple with a big A, not the fruit. Oh, well.
And you know, Teresa is so right. I think the sad part here is that I think most of us believe we are immune. But here's the bad news. The bad news is it's when we believe we are immune to all this stuff, we are most affected by it. And my mission with Writing Brand Wars has been to make the consumer perhaps get a wake-up call, a bit of a shock, but also for companies to realize if they want to keep loyal consumers in the future, they can't keep pushing the ball as much as they do. They need to wake up to something called with ethics.
But I think that Teresa is not unlike a lot of us. We think that we're above all of this,
yeah,
that the other people are the suckers.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're suggesting, on one way or another, we're all going to get caught.
Well, you know, I think the reality is that when we actually did a reality experiment for my book called The Morgerton. We had a real family moving into a home in L.A., and over 3 months we were monitoring them using 35 cameras, and then we asked them to spread the word of mouth about brands. Now, here's a shocking part we learned. We learned that 51% of everything you and I talk about at the dining table is about brands. More than 25% in fact, of everything you and I talk about throughout the entire day is with brand references. So basically, 1/4 of our life is about brands. We're just not aware of it.
My guest is Martin Lindstrom, whose latest book is Brandwashed, Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy, with a foreword by Morgan Spurlock. It's published by Crown Business. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also a brand. I'm Leonard Lopate. I guess I'm a brand, too. In Chapter 2, you've called Chapter 2 Peddling Panic and Paranoia, Why Fear Sells, and you describe how hand gels have made enormous profits between the 2003 SARS outbreak and the more recent H1N1 in 2009. Has our war with germs really become a global family affair?
Absolutely. Just think about it. When did you start to use these hand sanitizing products? I started to use it a couple of years ago, but I think it was out of reach just 5 years ago. What happened was that as we had the swine flu and we had some of the other different types of viruses coming out in the world, we got scared. What we know today, and that's what I'm writing a lot about in the book, is that those hand sanitizing products are not helping us not to get this scare. In fact, it has almost no effect compared to if I'm using soap or water. So it was a way to push us into a habit of using sanitizing product. Now,
so in fact, some scientists say that we need some contact with germs because it helps us build up resistance to germs.
Absolutely. And I think you're so right when you're saying it, because when we look at Japan, the biggest crisis they have beside, unfortunately, a tsunami is that their immune system is going down. We now are seeing that mothers are so afraid of making the babies come in contact with soil and natural dust that the immune system goes down, and now we actually have huge problems in Japan. And I think we will see a somewhat similar trend here. We become so obsessed with cleanness and sanitary behavior that actually kills our immune system. And that's really the technique which are now used across every board.
And now we even have designer brands of hand gels.
You do, and you have it built into clothing items. So you buy a shirt which is self-cleansing with chemicals in it. And because it's addictive, I'm sure that most people today cannot leave home without that little bottle where they want to squeeze some Purell in their hands. That means that you are all putting a pressure on each other. I was down at a New York restaurant yesterday evening. I went straight in. There was a Purell machine where you could put some gel in your hand. I passed by it on purpose, and a lady ran after me and said, "Hey, you have to clean your hands." That's a whole new trend we are seeing, where we put a peer pressure on each other.
Well, we do it at the gym as well, where we're asked to wipe off anything we've touched with some sanitizing piece of cloth.
Exactly. And I arrived into Chicago's O'Hara the other day from an international flight. And at the airport, the first announcement was not "Welcome to the United States." It was, "Remember to use hand sanitizing gel before you go through custom."
You write about food-contaminated scares as well, like the one we're currently having with cantaloupes. How does a firm capitalize on foodborne illnesses? I would have thought it hurts people. Wow. I mean, it hurts companies that are in the business. If we hear about cantaloupes, we might worry about some other fruit.
Well, there's a couple of techniques which are used. I think the most prominent technique is to look into and plug into our search terms online. So if I, for example, type in, for example, flu, or I have a cold, then we know today that within 5 years that flu is going to break through in that local area. And doctors and nurses are using that to stock up. But now companies also are using those data. In this case, some companies in the sanitizing area are sending out buses promoting the brand just to days before it breaks through, because people are more primed or more likely to buy that product then.
And you also explain what the company Weather Trends International does and how they help companies like Walmart, Target, and Kohl's adjust their inventories to capitalize on the anxieties of the American public. That's the same sort of thing. In this case, it's not germs. There's Hurricane Irene coming, and you better buy a lot of water.
Yeah, and torches and batteries and stock up. And of course, there are a lot of good intentions here, no doubt about that. But there's also a commercial intention, that is that if they can make you buy those batteries, just another batch of them and more water and all that stuff, because it may be the last time you can buy that water, well, then you do buy more, and you also pay a premium price, which is exactly what we saw in New Jersey during the recent incident we had there with the weather, where people were paying up to $8 for a bottle of water.
Well, it didn't happen in Brooklyn. Every store I went to said, "We're out of batteries and don't ask about flashlights."
Perhaps as you'd learned from Walmart.
It didn't matter anyway. Tom in Brooklyn asks, I wonder if the current economic crisis is forcing consumers with less money to consider the ways that we're being manipulated in our buying habits.
Well, yes and no. We do see today that people are more cautious. But what's interesting is that so are the companies aware of that you are more cautious, so they place the offers in a more tactical way. Let me just give you an example. It's amazing to see how data mining now can map down your behavior. For example, credit card companies now know so much about you that, for example, if you buy, let's say, those mini little soft pads or pots you're putting under the legs of your chair to not scratch the floor, they know that you're paying your bills on time. Or if you buy carbon monoxide monitors, you're paying things on time. But if you buy chrome skull car accessories, you are most likely to miss your payment. So what the companies are doing now is to look at your purchase behavior patterns, and then they target you if you happen to be buying the right products, because then they know that you're more primed or more likely to not just pay your bill on time, but buy more.
A Stanford University study estimates that 6% of the population, that's 17 million Americans, suffers from a shopping addiction. And a more recent study published in the Journal of Consumer Research put the prevalence of shopping addiction even higher at 8.9%. We're talking about addiction in this case?
Absolutely. If you've met a person which is a shopaholic, which is, by the way, a clinical term used in invented in Germany after the Second World War, you will know that this is a serious disease. What happens is that we become obsessed. of generating what's called dopamine in our brain. Dopamine is what we call a neurotransmitter, which is released, which makes us feel good, somewhat similar to if we are on drugs or we drink alcohol. And dopamine becomes addictive because once it's flattening out, when I swipe the credit card through the scanner, well, then I want more of that good feeling.
And you tell us stories of a couple of people who have real problems. Carolyn Longmead, a middle-aged shopaholic secretary from the UK, who stole roughly $225,000 of a two-year period from a small electronics store that she worked at to fund her Louis Vuitton, Prada, and Gucci habits. That's pretty fancy stuff for somebody who's living on a rather small income. Another woman, Amy Gagner, spent $200,000 in shopping debt, and that was her whole life savings, and now she has to live without a computer credit card and checking account to prevent slipping back into debt. So is this something that is this like being an alcoholic? You just can't ever shop again?
It is. And it's funny you're saying it, because I went on a brand detox myself for this book, and I decided not to buy a single brand for a whole year. And it was an amazing experience, because after half a year I just gave up. You know, I went to Cyprus. I lost my suitcase on the plane. I was standing there in my T-shirt and my underwear. I had no clothes. I had to go into a kiosk and buy a T-shirt saying, "I love Cyprus," which I did a presentation in later on. But what was interesting is once I was sort of starting to buy stuff again, giving up, it's like the floodgates were opening and I just bought and bought and bought.
But also, it's almost impossible to avoid the big brands. I just came back from a vacation in Europe, and you go to a town like Bruges, which is supposedly this fabulous Middle Ages town, I guess it struck me more like Disneyland. But all the shops are the same shops that I would find here in New York.
Yeah.
And the same brands are being offered.
Yeah, because what happens is that one business model works in one country and then it's exported to hundreds of other countries. And what happens is that local, authentic feel is replicated in a mass production way rather than actually the local shop actually being a real and authentic. So we are seeing the pendulum right now is going to the extreme of mass production, and where we will very soon see that, you know, most stores will try to do whatever they can to be authentic, because that's what we long for in a world where everything is manufactured.
So they want to look authentic at the same time that they are really inauthentic.
Absolutely.
Brandwashed is Martin Lindstrom's latest book, Tricks Companies Use to Manipulate Our Minds and Persuade Us to Buy. It's published by Crown Business. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Pleasure.